Fred Film Radio is joining the Sydney Film Festival Australia.
Welcome back to the Big Fred Tuesday, and we are joined by Nessa Hardiman, director of Sea Fever, one of the films selected as part of this year's program for the European Film Promotions Europe Voices of Women in Film program in collaboration with the Sydney Film Festival. Nessa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Matt.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. And Nessa, these are crazy times that we're living in right now. And I just wanted to start off our chat by asking you how you're doing and has your creativity and work been affected by the current health emergency?
Well, I was filming a drama with Netflix in Israel when the lockdown happened. So I flew home to Dublin and I've been in Dublin with my family ever since. I am really happy to say that we've had a reasonably good experience here in Ireland. There has, of course, been some tragedy, which is really sad. But overall, we have not had the terrible peak that has stressed other countries' resources. So I'm relieved to say that we're in reasonably good nick here in Dublin.
That's good to hear because I am from there. So hopefully I'll be back one day.
Well, we're looking forward to having you.
Well, all right. So I watched your film Sea Fever last night. Found it very frightening, especially relevant to these days, actually. But just for the benefit of our listeners, before we start talking about it in more detail, would you be able to maybe say a few words to introduce the film, just what it's about, as much as you'd like to say about it?
Sure. Well, Sea Fever is a psychological thriller with a sci-fi element. It's a tense, propulsive story that really essentially explores ethical questions about taking responsibilities for ourselves, for each other and for our world. The story is about a marine biology student called Siobhan, who prefers to spend her time alone in her lab. And for her doctorate, she has to endure a week on a ragged fishing trawler where she's miserably at odds with the close-knit crew. She's neurodivergent, so she thinks differently, and it's very difficult for her to make connections with people that she doesn't know. But out in the deep Atlantic, an unfathomable life form ensnares the boat, and members of the crew start to succumb to a strange infection. And at that point, Siobhan kind of has to overcome her alienation and anxiety and really win the crew's trust because she's the only one who might be able to navigate them home with her skills. But along the way, she's facing ethical and scientific and deep emotional challenges.
And of course, back when the film premiered, I'm just trying to picture it now. I presume most people could not have anticipated the state of emergency that occurred a few months later. But I wonder, did this film originate from concerns that you had about the possibility of the emergence of possibly even a global pandemic?
Well, really, the film premiered on the opening night of the Toronto International Film Festival. It premiered The Discovery Strand, which is about visionary new directors, I'm happy to say. And that, of course, was before COVID gripped the world. Now, essentially, when I was writing the film and when we were making it, the story was about the ethics of protecting ourselves versus protecting others. And the root of the story, the central metaphor of the story, as far as we were concerned, was climate change. So the film is really informed by this painful awareness of how fragile our biosphere and our ecosystem is. But really what I wanted to explore in terms of the crisis that we have around our climate is how raw economic need forces people to act against urgent ecological concerns. And the big theme of the story is reason and the scientific method versus magical thinking. In other words, being able to see clearly what is actually happening and what we need to do versus the very human desire to sort of build ourselves a comforting lie that makes it seem like everything is okay and we can just act the way we've always acted and we don't have to take responsibility. And I think that's really why the film feels very apposite, unfortunately, for our current environment. Because what do you do when you're making a story like this? What you do is you say, okay, the boat is a microcosm for the culture. Where are the cracks in the culture that if we put pressure on them, we're going to really see those cracks open? And the really big cracks in our culture, it seemed to me when I was writing, were this idea that we are all independent agents in competition with one another. And that if you win, I lose. And if I win, you lose. This kind of zero-sum game, which is a sort of neoliberalist idea that there's no such thing as society. And of course, that's in total contradiction with the way that we need to think when we think about climate change. But unfortunately, the advent of the COVID crisis has really put exactly the same pressures onto our culture. And we see the same cracks in our culture opening up. This idea that economic need trumps every other need. Economic need is more important than, you know, the lives of the most vulnerable people in our society. Those are the kind of conflicts that emerge. And I think what COVID has taught us is the same thing, really, that we were trying to explore in the film, the same thing that we're addressing when it comes to climate change, which is really no man is an island, as an island, and that we see ourselves as atomized individuals in competition at our peril, because that's a misrecognition of what we are. Actually, we are within a broader community of me, my family, my community, and the world, and we're a dynamic and integrated part of a greater whole, and how each of us acts benefits or works to the detriment of the other in unison rather than in competition.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I do believe that, like, progressively it becomes clear that the film also talks about responsibility, right?
Yeah, that's really what the film is about.
And it's funny to see it now, because I was watching it and hearing some words like quarantine, I realize now how the significance of those words has changed for me, and possibly for the most of us.
Yeah, the film really, it feels incredibly close to where we are now. And, you know, people have said to me, well, obviously this is a coincidence and it's really prescient. Now, it is a coincidence. Obviously, we had no idea that we were going to be facing quarantine situations. But it's not surprising that something that the film, which is kind of looking at what are the central issues that we need to struggle with culturally, that those issues come up in a different way later in the same year. Like, that's not surprising, because they are the big issues that we have to struggle with culturally. And the big issues are raw economic need versus urgent biological and ecological concerns. Like, that's the big thing that we as a culture have to deal with. So it's not a massive surprise then that the film feels resonant when we come up against the next major cultural crisis.
Now, you described the film as a psychological thriller with sci-fi elements and so on. And these sci-fi elements, these genre elements, I was wondering whether, I mean, what do you think? Do they have is there communicative power to them?
Oh, 100%. I love cinema that's representational and metaphorical. In other words, that it feels authentic and truthful and feels like lived experience, and the characters are rich and feel like real three-dimensional human beings with their own stories. But I also love a cinema that brings those characters in that very real world a dreamlike, a single what-if element that's a big kind of Brechtian metaphor. And for me, I really want to use the language of cinema to explore ideas. I want to use powerful cinematic imagery. I want to use authentic performance and complex soundscapes to touch on cultural sore spots through these kind of dreamlike correlatives that operate to allow us to approach very real, very urgent questions through the powerful and very human language of metaphor. As a teenager, I remember, I think I was about 12, I went to see Neil Jordan's adaptation of Angela Carter's story, The Company of Wolves, and I was really struck by it. That notion that you could use the language of metaphor, you know, the language of Fritz Lang, to articulate a grown-up form of storytelling, that you could touch on things that were complex and adult themes using the intrinsic primal dream language of cinema.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Dreamlike. I like that word, because yes, there is that dreamlike quality to cinema in general, but of course it is enhanced in films like these. You mentioned Fritz Lang as well.
And I think it's really been taken up in recent years. Like, I felt very influenced by the palette and tone of the cinema of Southeast Asia. You know, people like Park Chan-wook and Wong Kar-wai and Bong Joon-ho and Ang Lee. This fusion of a cinema of ideas with a cinema of spectacle, which I think is really powerful.
Another thing that I wondered while I was watching Sea Fever was that it must have been challenging to direct a movie almost entirely set on the open water, right?
I know. What was I thinking?
Was it challenging? Did you find it challenging?
Yeah. It was very difficult. Yeah, filming on a boat is, as any idiot in the street will tell you, filming on a boat is really hard. So what was I thinking? We had a tiny budget and I went, I know, let's film it entirely at sea. But what I really wanted from that was, I wanted that idea of a microcosm. I wanted that idea of a community of people who are trapped together. who could represent, you know, a broader community, because you can't get away from each other. So there are several things that that gives us. It gives us the opportunity to talk about the very specifics of what's happening in that particular industry, where they're really at the cutting edge of what's happening in the climate crisis. And they're really at the cutting edge of that incredibly difficult moral conundrum of economic imperative. These people are losing their livelihoods because of industrial scale fishing. And if they want to continue their livelihoods, they have to go into deeper and deeper waters, and they have to do things like bottom trawling, which are, you know, they know that it's wrong and they know that it's destructive. But really, if you're at the pin of your collar economically, and the people in the story, you know, the people who are running the boat, have a moral obligation and a moral duty to provide for the people that they employ. And so they're stuck between this rock and a hard place of knowing that they're damaging their own and global long-term interests by doing what they're doing. But in the short term, they have to stay alive. They have to feed themselves and their families.
Here's possibly a silly question that I just thought of there. Are there any parallels between the fishing trawler, the people in this, the fishing trawler, and the film industry, and working within the film industry?
Oh God, 100%. It was one of the jokes that I made to the producers, going, essentially, the people who skipper the boat are like the producers. You know, they're trying to keep everything, on target by managing the finances. But it's not always in the best interest of the people who are actually doing the job. I don't mean that about our producers at all, of course. But I think it's not just the film industry. I think it's true of many industries. You know, it's ecological versus economic crisis. And it's very difficult. People find it very difficult to make those choices when they are vulnerable, when they are already themselves very precarious. And that's the issue. And one of the other big issues in the story that I wanted to explore was this idea of reason and the scientific method in balance with magical thinking. You know, obviously the story focuses on this figure of the scientist and how important it is to be able to look truthfully and honestly and without fear at what's really happening, and then to act accordingly. And how comforting it is to consider the opposite of that, which is magical thinking, which is not always bad. You know, in the story, I hope it's clear that there are aspects to myth and faith and parable that are powerful and nourishing and valuable, and that allow us a different way into understanding the natural world and understanding our place in the natural world. But the risks of magical thinking are that it can turn into comforting thinking. And that's, I think, where we run into danger.
Oh, let's talk about that actually for a little bit. Actually, the sea is traditionally linked with folklore and superstition, but also there's a classical association between women and superstition. You know, given that the protagonist of the movie is a young woman, how would you describe the importance of these associations like superstition, folklore, sea, and women?
I don't really see that connection with gender, actually. That's not something that I'm aware of, or that I would be particularly sensitive to in relation to that. I think gender, for me, gender in the story is more about, there's a great, neurodivergent writer called Zosia Zaks who came up with the aphorism that the ship of humanity requires all hands on deck to right itself. And I think that was one of the things that was floating through my mind as I was writing the story, was the ship of humanity requires all hands on deck to right itself. In other words, it's very important for us to recognize the qualities and value of all of the participants in our lives, regardless of how they wear their gonads or how much melanin they have in their skin. And I think it's important for us to tell stories about how people are limited culturally by the obstacles that are put in front of them because of their ethnicity, and how people are limited in terms of what they can achieve by cultural obstacles that are put in front of them because of their sex. And it's very important that we tell those stories. But I also feel that it's very important for us to tell stories about those people in their full humanity. You know, it's important for us to see ourselves as women, as people of color, on screen in heroic positions, living big lives. And for me, that was the important thing in this film, was not to focus too much on the kinds of obstacles that are placed culturally in the way of gifted, intelligent people of color and gifted, intelligent women, but rather to see those gifted, intelligent people acting heroically in a way that feels uplifting and exciting for the women and people of color who are watching. And I think those kinds of heroic stories are needed. I think I need those stories. I think all of us need those stories, as well as the stories that focus on the kinds of obstacles that are placed in front of us as women and as people of color. So for the purpose of this film, I didn't really want to focus on sexism and I didn't really want to focus on racism. I wanted to focus on how talented and heroic particularly the man of color and the woman in the story are.
Well, I do feel that's an important message, especially at this historical moment. But I was reading a bit about your background and was intrigued when I found that you actually have a master's degree in politics and aesthetics.
I have a master's in politics and aesthetics, and I have a PhD in film theory.
Mm. And do you feel that that master's degree actually has influenced your work in film?
I think the master's and the PhD have both influenced and enriched my thinking really significantly. I think they both inform. I think there's one thing that I feel very strongly as a filmmaker, and I think a lot of filmmakers would agree, that, you know, I'm sure you have found in your life, there are a number of people who will say to you, oh, you know, I saw this film when I was young and it really changed my mind about what I wanted to do with my life. Or I saw this figure in film and that really encouraged me to pursue a particular path. Or I heard this piece of dialogue in a film and it really made sense to me and it really resonated and helped me to do something. And what do we know from that? We know that film is one of the storytelling, screen storytelling is one of the really significant components of contemporary culture. And we, as a people, understand ourselves through storytelling. It's how we work. You know, there's a reason that the Bible is written in the form of stories, or that the Quran, or that any of those kind of sacred books about philosophy are often articulated through parable. It's because we understand the world through storytelling. And so what does that tell us about filmmakers? It tells us that we make culture. We make culture. And therefore, it's really important that we take responsibility for the kind of culture that we make. And I think one of the things that exploring the world of politics and aesthetics and film theory has done for me is really make that feel urgent and important, to take responsibility for the meanings that you make and for the way in which you intervene and articulate story, because it has an impact on the kind of cultural environment of the people who see it.
Who are some of your favorite film theorists?
My favorite film theorists. There's a question you don't get asked every day. I mean, I suppose I don't feel that I adhere slavishly to any one person's particular outlook. Like, there were a lot of books that I read that I felt very nourished by. But I think it's more, the people that I think are the most powerful film theorists are the people who are the practitioners. So I would look to people like Fassbinder, who's really kind of articulating a form of social theory through his cinema, or people like Catherine Bigelow, who's articulated a very particular kind of perspective on masculinity through her cinema, or people like Jane Campion, who articulates a very resonant form of female eroticism through her cinema. So I suppose I would see those people as theorists who are articulating their theory in a really meaningful and emotionally resonant way.
Nessa, thank you very much. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
A great pleasure talking to you, Matt. Thanks for taking the time.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.